there's not one way to play it, right? It's a power game
Yeah.
nowadays to a large extent, but not everyone's going to hit it miles.
Yeah.
So you look at players who don't hit it miles, you think, okay, they're excelling in other parts of the game. So
Right.
where are they excelling? They're excelling by, marginal gain in putting or marginal gain in chipping or bunkers or strategy of where they're hitting their tee shot or the strategy of where they're missing it.
Yeah.
There's lots of different ways to do it, and it's a matter of figuring out, how someone does it their best. You don't all do it the same. I know a lot of people who hit it a long way can't break 80.
And they probably still gain off the tee too, even though they're hitting it 280, you know. This
So
is
people can get obsessed with the numbers of, on TrackMan and stuff, especially the modern kids. They're obsessed with their ball speed, obsessed with their club speed, and neglecting a lot of their game actually because of that. I sometimes with some players, a lot of college players actually, they're so obsessed with speed and distance that they screw their geometry up. And so whatever gain they get in distance is circumvented by the fact that they can't hit it straight. That doctrine of, hit it as hard as you can and run after it and find it. I don't agree with that at all. I think you've got to hit it far, but you've also got to control it. So some college players actually reduce their speed to improve their smash factor, weirdly. And they're like, what? You want me to reduce them? Yeah, 2 or 3 miles an hour, but let's improve the geometry so we get all the numbers improving, not just the speed. So I think there's an obsession with speed for sure.
I think there's been a doctrine too of that 65 wide number that Decade says to use. So like all the I see a lot of kids, and I did it a lot myself. It's like, oh well, it's 65, I'm gonna send driver no matter what kind of hole it is or how I'm hitting it. And you just like live by that doctrine, and all of a sudden you shoot 80 because you hit four balls when you didn't need to
Totally.
do that to yourself.
No, I mean you need to have decades of great systems, no doubt about it. But you still need to have your golf acumen with you, right? You should have what I call a reactive game plan to some extent. Yeah, you're following the rules, but it's not set in stone. You might have that dispersion number, but you might think, geez, this doesn't fit my eye at all. I'm just going to bunt one down there, even though it might go slightly against the doctrine that you've been doing. You just got to make marginal gains and avoid the mistakes is the big picture, isn't it?
This is the Tournament Code.
There's something you said right there, Jonathan, that I thought was interesting. Talking about, working with a lot of what you said has been very interesting, but working with the players that you work with and all the, especially this obsession with speed and trying to hit the ball farther. What have you noticed? Tell us quickly, just a little background so people know some of your credentials, but then tell us what you've noticed working with most recently players, trying to get speed and A, whether they need it and what you're kind of doing on that front.
Well, obviously, my name's Jonathan Yarwood. I'm a top 100 teacher, number one teacher in the state of New Jersey, which is my summer place. I've had a 25-year career in elite golf. I've coached four number one juniors, for example, two US amateur champions, a US Open winner. You name it. I've sent kids to OSU, ASU, Berkeley, all over the place. So I've had a unique career in the fact I've developed kids from 11 years old to the tour. I've also taken tour players and turned them into major winners and helped them on their road to recovery if they were lost their way. I've worked with players like Nelly Korda, Michael Campbell, lo loads of different players, Ben Ahn, all sorts of people along the line. So that's my kind of background. It's been elite based. I've been based at residential junior academies or on the tour most of my career. So to answer your question with the obsession with speed, yeah, as I said to you, I think there's so many people obsessed with two numbers, which is their club head speed and ball speed, which is fine. It's a power game. You have got to hit it a long way to be competitive. There's no question about it. But I think if you, and again, there's a doctrine out there, look, smash it as far as you can, run after it, hit it again, find it. And I don't believe I've never worked on that. I've always worked on creating good geometry, which produces good speed with a with some ball control. If you look at the best players in the world, they control it. I mean, all you have to do is watch the PGA Tour at any given moment, and those guys can just hit it so straight. I was at the Masters the other day, and two pretty much nondescript players, even though they're playing in the Masters, so they're good. I mean, I stood behind them on the first tee, and I'm, you know, it's quite a wide hole, but there's still a bit of pressure on you. And he just went, you know, there's like a 3 yard movement in the ball flying 300 yards. You know, so not only do they hit it far, these top players, but they hit it straight. So, you know, you just got to be careful you don't chase that speed number and, you know, watch Kyle Berkshire and Bryson when he's on form on YouTube and all that stuff and think, okay, that's the only number in golf. It's not. You know, you've got to be efficient in your golf swing. You've got to, I have a periodized training model where people work on their technique at certain times. They work on their geometry at certain times. They work on how it moves together at certain times. And they work on speed at certain times. And you try and marry all those together to produce a robust golf swing that not only hits it far and is competitive, but also hits it straight. So, you know, I think that blending all that together, especially when you look at TrackMan, you can have a great speed number that's absolutely killed by hitting down at it too much or, you know, too much across it or whatever, which, you know, it negates whatever speed you've got. So it's a balance. It's a balance. But speed and power are definitely part of the equation, obviously.
What do you mean when you say the players work on their geometry?
Well, just how a swing kind of fits together and what it looks like is what I spend a lot of time with. How do you harmonize the components to produce speed, but also to produce a straight shot? So, you know, the geometry would be looking at the planes and the face and the widths and, you know, the movement of how the body and the club and the arms interact. You know, it's no good having a ton of speed and the club's, you know, the past seven left and it's, you know, getting steep on the way down, for example. You know, that would be poor geometry, but tons of speed. And I see a lot of college kids who I get coming in with pretty much homemade swings and hoping they're going to make it because they've got, you know, 130 mile an hour club head speed. I'm like, well, yeah, but you blasted three of those 109 feet right. You know, so, you know, you've got to be careful a little bit that, especially with someone like Scotty on the scene and some of the players on the scene with what I call quite homemade swings, right? So, you know, I look at a player and I don't think you should leave them alone totally. I think you should, especially young kids that I've developed them with great golf swings. As I say, there's a time and a place to work on it with a periodized training model. But if you can underdevelop someone and you can overdevelop someone if you're not careful. So, you know, some of these kids who are just standing there with any old golf swing, you know, the odds are pretty good you're not going to make it because Scotty is a one-off. And if you look at his swing as he comes into the ball, actually, it's quite conventional. But, you know, you can't have a homemade swing and tons of speed and hope for the best nowadays. You've got to marry it with certain ingredients and get what I call a blueprint. And each person's blueprint's individual. Each person's blueprint is based on facts and evidence and how they move and TPI screenings and stuff like that. So you could just make everyone a great version of themselves, but you have to get a modicum of control of what's going on in there by creating decent geometry, marrying that to, you know, good movement, good forces, good speed. And out the other side, you'll get some decent track band numbers and someone who can actually control it as well as hit it far.
Looking at, so I think last year on the PGA Tour was actually the first year that average driving distance decreased. Do you think a lot of the pros out there are seeing this trend where it's not necessarily hit it as hard as you can and go find it? And they're actually like targeting laying back in spots and being a little bit more strategic. And that's why that's happening? Or do you think
it's
just kind
possibly,
of...
Yeah. Possibly they're kind of using the decade system a little bit, possibly, and they're dialing back on certain things here and there. Again, I think they're realizing it's not all about power and all about speed. It's about, you know, golf's a 3D game of chess, isn't it? You know, so, you know, some of these holes are difficult. Some of these holes are very strategic. Some of these holes, you know, you've got to dial back a little bit. So I think there's an element of that in there, but maybe, you know, a decrease, you're probably talking a yard, 2 yards or something like that. And maybe we're at the boundary of the legality of a driver. Maybe you can't improve the driver anymore. You can't, you know, put anything else into it, really. So, you know, maybe you're not going to see huge increases like you have in the past because they were ball and club driven mainly. And I think they've developed it so far to the boundary of the law. I mean, we just saw that with Rory the other day where he was not a legal club. I don't think he's the only one with a not quite a conforming club. He just got tested and got a bit unlucky. But, you know, I think it's partly lots of little factors, but, you know, it's still going a long way, aren't they, in general? But it's still interesting all the different ways you can play the game to me. You know, it's not just the power guys that win it every week, is it? You know, you look at the US Open this week, you want someone who's going to hit it straight, because you hit in that stuff there this week, you're toast. You are toast. I mean, that's like cabbage around the fairways there.
It looks brutal up there. When it comes to geometry, you know, getting somebody's geometry good so they can not just hit it, you know, hard, but hit it straight. Do you have any preferences? You know, some teachers have preferences as to what they like to see in a golf swing. What are your preferences, if you have any?
Yeah, I'm not a method teacher. I don't teach a method. I think to be a good teacher, all-round teacher, you have to be versed in all styles, right? Every swing style, from stack and tilt to lead wrist flex and close face, and you know, one plane, two plane, one axis, front post to back post. You need knowledge of it all, right? So what I do is I look at someone's history. I screen them with a TPI screen. I look at them when they were a kid. I always have a look at stuff when they're a kid, because that's often movement patterns are developed early on. And then I try to get some footage, especially if they're pro players, and when they played their best. You know, when did you play? But what were you doing when you played your best? So you just, you know, based around that, I also measure people's bodies. I measure their wingspan relative to their height. I, you know, because if you've got long arms, you're going to have a different plane to someone with short arms. You know, but so. There's just all you're trying to do is make someone an efficient version of themselves based on how they're built, how they move, what they've historically done. And what you don't want to do is put them in a mold and go, right, this is how I teach. You stand on your left foot, you lean on your left foot, and you whack it. You know, like as there's always been fashions in golf, hasn't there? And I won't name them, but you can think of, you know, quite a few that have come and gone. And the ones that have stood the test of time, or the teachers that have stood the test of time, are the ones that don't really teach a method, you know, like the Butch Harmons and the Strawn Foleys and the Chris Comos and all those type of people. You know, they don't teach a method. They just make you more efficient, like I do, based on what's in front of them on a case-by-case basis.
What technology are you using in your teaching setups?
When I'm in technical mode, obviously there's lots of different modes and different ways to practice and prepare for tournaments and stuff, but when I'm in technical mode, as I say, I use the TPI screening first. I look at people's how they're built and stuff. I look at grip strength. I look at dorsiflexion, all sorts of stuff. Then I've got swing catalyst force plates just to see what the forces are doing in their swing. I've got TrackMan with TrackMan AI running, and then four video cameras running at the same time as well. So, you know, basically allows me to quantify everything that I'm seeing, and also stuff I can't see. And that allows me to make an informed choice. Do I need all that stuff? No, I don't, not really. I can do it with my eye in a car park because I've been doing it so long. But it helps me, and it helps the player to understand, and it allows me to benchmark them. So it's like, okay, here's where you're at. Here's where you start. Here's the facts of what you are and how you're moving, what your pressure's doing, what your mass is doing, what the ball's doing, what the path's doing. That's the facts. That's where we start. And here's my intervention. So, you know, I always like to say that I measure with science, but I teach with art. So, you know, I'm looking for one phrase, one feel, one something that will press one button which lights the whole dash up. That's what a good teacher does. I never give anyone more than one thing back or one thing through, that is for sure. And if you're good at what you do, I mean, I like to post my actual live lessons online, which not many coaches do. Because I like people to see, look, here's the before, here's an intervention, and here's the after. Does that player own it? No, they don't. They're only renting it at the moment. But I've created a quick fact-based solution for that player and that individual. And then, you know, you then start, as I say, getting away a little bit from technology, or paring it down a little bit. And you can use technology in really intelligent ways. You know, people, you know, have TrackMan and they look at 5,000 tiles all at the same time. I don't do that. When I first worked with Nelly Korda a while ago, I don't work with her now, but in the past, she'd never used a TrackMan. This was only 3 years ago, 2 years ago. She'd never used one. She didn't believe in it. She literally said to me, "I don't believe in a TrackMan." I went, "Okay, well, if you want me to help you, you better buy one next week, and we'll have a look at it." So she bought one. And she used three tiles all season, and she won the Olympic gold medal. She became world number one, and all, and a career low round, and all that stuff. And all she was looking at was face, path, attack angle, but it helped her. You know, so you know, you've got to use technology in an intelligent way. And as a teacher, you can't buy being a good teacher just by having all the latest bells and whistles. You know, people seem to think you do. Oh, I've got a TrackMan. Okay, great. Well, technology can make you look stupid if you don't know what you're doing. Because if you measure with technology and make an intervention that's inaccurate, it doesn't work, all of a sudden, all those numbers go wrong. It's like the TrackMan number will change, the force number will change, the force distribution changes. So you've got to know what you're doing, really, and use it in an intelligent way as a player and a coach. And ultimately, you want to get away from it because it's an artistic game. It's an ever-changing game in an ever-changing environment, really, is what golf is. So you need to practice in different ways to enable that to happen. So there's a technical way of practicing, obviously, with technology and what I call block practice, where you can get your benchmark and create your blueprint. And then from that blueprint, the fact-based blueprint, you just make toolbox of ideas that keeps you on track technically. So you keep yourself within that space technically. So you become less technical as a result. You're not guessing, you're not searching, you're not asking, you're not, okay, here's how my swing works based on what we found. Here's the solution, and here's my two or three things that keeps me in place. So then you can start looking at the rest of the game and trying to get more artistic and flowy and flairy around that. And so there's lots of, let's say, lots of different ways to practice. There's to prepare for a tournament and peak for a tournament. There's what's called a periodized training model, where you do some technical work. So you're kind of into the nuts and bolts. You've got all the technology and all that stuff, and then you gently move away from that, and you start getting more into external mode, trying to keep that feel that you've created. So that's like what I call a blending phase, and that requires a little bit different type of practice away from the block practice. And then you move into the third phase, which is just being competitive, which is less balls, more routine, randomizing your targets, randomizing what you do, creating what we call challenge points. So you try and make your practice more like you're going to play. And then once you've done that, the final phase is a very important one, which is the rest and evaluation phase. So you've got to literally rest your mind, rest your body, and evaluate what's happened, where you're at, and you know, stats programs and stuff like that are helpful in that regard.
You said you taught a lot of juniors, like from the time they're 11 years old on to college and tour. When you teach a junior who's just now getting into the game, do you think it's better to teach them from the hole backwards to the tee, or teach them to swing it as hard as they can and then kind of figure out the game from there?
Think it's a blend of both, really. I say with the kids I've developed, I've got a nice little system. I think, you know, standing there and smashing it is fine, but the problem is, obviously, there is a time and a place to stand there and smash it. But if you let someone just grip it any old how, and you let someone just stand and smash it any old way, often that's when they make they create their movement pattern, which is something they're going to fight for the rest of their life. So, you know, sure, let them stand there and smash it, and have smashing it as part of their training for sure. But also, you might have a period where you go, come on, let's just grip it better. Let's just stand nicely. Introduce them to some, this is how your body works. This is what the club should do, and blend those things together. And I think, as you alluded to, Cooper, I think, you know, teaching from the green backwards is always good. It's never a bad thing, is it? You know, because they're going to learn chipping and putting and feel and all that other stuff. But one thing, especially with beginner kids, one thing that for my mind is non-negotiable, and to start with, is a pain in the ass because you've got to adjust it every time. It would be never letting them grip it poorly, and never letting them stand poorly. Because if you've got any, you know, you see any old grip like this, and the thumbs are like that, and hold it like a baseball bat, you know, they're going to create such a weird little action from there. They've got to get used straight away to how to hold it. You know, if you look at some of the best swings in the world as kids, you look at Tiger Woods and those guys. You look at that Tiger Woods swing, and he's like 11 or 10 years old or something, a little kid with a big hat like this on. He swung it his best he's ever swung it, in my view, at that age, because kids at that age, if you get them to hold it properly, you get them to stand reasonably well, they're not strong enough to influence it negatively. They're not strong enough to move the club out of position. The club will just flow around them. So, you know, I spend a lot of time just getting the club flowing, get it balanced, getting their body to complement that, and then just gently add speed as you go along. But I'm not a big believer, and I know there's other ways of doing it. I'm just telling you how I've done it historically and had success. You know, I'm not a big believer in stand there, smash it with any old swing, because I see loads of them on the range at different places I go at the club I'm at. And I just think, well, at some stage, you've got a swing rebuild coming. Yeah, you've learned ballistics for sure, but you haven't learned geometry and shape and form. Marry those two together and you've got a winner. So, and there's a time and a place for getting technical. There's a time and a place for doing it too much. You know, little kids, I just get them to grip it properly, get them to stand properly, you know, talk to them about, you know, getting the club balanced and shifting their mass towards the target and getting it balanced on the other side, and then just say, right, off you go, and that's it. And then they'll learn the touch of the field through chipping and punting and all that stuff, and then just loads of games and loads of playing. You know, young kids have got to get out there and play and compete and have fun and chase after it.
When it comes to evaluating swings, when you talked about, you know, someone, you know, at least being able to hit it straight, but they're fighting their swing or they're doing a lot of work to be able to get to square / hitting it well. If I'm somebody listening to this and let's say, you know, I think that I feel like I'm fighting my swing, this might be hard to describe. What does that feeling look like? How does it manifest itself in the, not necessarily the scores, but how the ball travels?
You want to get your swing to a point where your extreme's not too bad, right? What's the worst thing that a good player does is they double miss it, right? They got a two-way miss. That's the worst thing. So you should figure out with your coach, right, why does that rear its head? What am I doing? How do I kind of get that dispersion down a little bit? So you should have an understanding of your swing, which is why we use technology, which is why we use facts and evidence to understand it. So, and it's all on a case-by-case basis. Your swing thought and your swing toolbox will be different to Cooper's and Jack's. You know, it's a very much a bespoke case-by-case thing. But what I do with players is I obviously get them to understand it. I get them to be self-reliant. But I also develop an emergency swing, let's say. I mean, what was Tiger's emergency swing when he struggled? Stinger. You know, what's Rory's? He's got a three-quarter arm swing, little bunt. You know, everyone's got a little go-to swing where they just go, look, because at any given time, doesn't matter how good you are, you're going to have your A game, B game, C game, and even your D game, right? Any given point. So it's how, you know, anyone can manage their A game. It pops up on tour probably three times a year, right? You're not going to often see a tour player, even when they won, go, geez, I couldn't play any better. You know, there's always a shoot 62, and go, oh my God, I hit it so bad today. They'd say to the caddy or say to me, you know. So, you know, your B and C game and D game are going to show up. So how do you deal with that? Well, you need to prepare to deal with that because it's going to happen. So you develop a shot, a go-to shot. You know, it might be, hey, I'm going to aim left and just cut the crap out of it off the tee because I can predict that it's going to do that. It's out of control, but it's going to get me to the clubhouse until I can figure it out, and I'm not going to get to the clubhouse, you know, in an ambulance. I'm going to get there reasonably, you know. So you develop some go-to shots would be my thought.
I've been to the clubhouse in an ambulance a few times.
It's very easily done. It's a tough game, this one, buddy, as you know.
All right, let's say we got a player who's got good geometry. You know, we're not like out of this world, and then they actually need in this case to get more speed, and you look at their game, you're like, all right, in order to probably be able to play at the level they want to play, they need more speed. What levers are you looking to pull to get somebody more speed?
Well, physiology, first of all, you know, you've got to be strong, fast, and you've got to have great mobility. So again, harking back to the TPI stuff, that's fundamental, really. You've got to know how strong someone is, how fast they are, and how mobile they are. Right, so you need strength, power, and mobility. Often people, even young kids, I screened a guy the other day, he's only 15, become a very nice little player, but his hips are totally locked up. He's 15 years old. You know, he's at the age where he wants some abs and he wants to show the chicks, and all of a sudden he's locked his hips up because all winter he's been working on his abs and his ass. I'm like, mate, what happened? You know, you've got the lower body screening of a 90-year-old. So, you know, that's the start. And then again, technology steps in. You know, you've got to look at and have an understanding of how forces are created, right? So speed is created by force. It's not created by magic. So how do you optimize someone's forces? That's why we've got things like the swing catalyst and all this 3D stuff and what have you. So we can see the sequence of events. And again, it varies a little bit from player to player. Some people are stronger on their front foot, some are stronger on their back foot. We're even at the point now where we fine-tune their footwear to their swing to maximize forces. I did an experiment a couple of years ago where on the force plates where I had a kid with bare feet, some raised Nike style shoes, some flat FootJoy style shoes, some FootJoy classic block heel shoes, and didn't give him a lesson. And yet the variances in how far it went were 15 yards. And I didn't give him a lesson. I just changed his footwear. So we're at the point now to start looking at little things like that, like literally shoe fitting being part of the club fitting and process. And you're trying to find marginal gains like you would in a business to find where speed leaks are, power leaks are. Is the vertical force too late? Is there too much horizontal force? Is the torque force ramped up enough? And we know so much more about it than we used to. We literally know the code, as I put it now, which is why, and not just me, loads of coaches know the code. You guys are going to know a lot about it from consuming content and stuff. So, we're not guessing, we're not in the dark. We know more about golf and golf swings and golf anatomy and how to generate speed and power and force than ever. And it's only going to get better and better and better. And that's why there's such strength and depth on tour. We talked earlier on about Cooper. If you stuck him on a range, he's a great player, as a pro, and went to Q school and stuff, he wouldn't look out of place on the tour because there's so much strength in depth. Getting on the tour, not being on the tour, being on the Korn Ferry or being on the PGA Tour is such a fine line. It might be that week at Q school you weren't hot, but some other guy was. And then 6 months later, it might be vice versa. Yeah, the if you had Q school 6 months later, Cooper might have gone in and the other guy might not have gone on because they'd been hot that week. You don't know. It's just there's so much strength in depth because of how what we know, because we know the code. Across the coaching network, not just me. There's loads of great coaches out there with great information, doing some great stuff with people. This is why they're all so bloody good.
That makes sense. It was interesting. It's interesting. One of the things you said right there, especially when it comes to the depth in professional golf, what do you think separates, like really separates, like again, there's the eye test, there's what's going on, like actually, so there's the eye test, what we see, and like, okay, well, Cooper looks like he fits in. And then there's the, okay, now they go out and play and Cooper doesn't fit in. What do you think? And there's lots of pretty swings in this world.
We're not bagging you, Cooper, by the way. We're not bagging
Yeah,
anybody.
absolutely. He's admitted it. He's got a great game. I love watching his game. But and Cooper for an amateur is very good. Another year we almost made the USAM, so not like out of his depth. It's been a couple of years that he's been like that. But what do you think separates pretty swing, good geometry from get ball in hole in least amount of strokes? Is there anything?
Yeah, it's like the will to win, really. It's like any great sports people. They just have this massive will to win, often fueled by something like, I'll show you, and they've been wrong somewhere along the line, or people didn't believe in them, or I'll show you. That sort of fuel and fire inside people that separates them, where they're, they end up capable of doing amazing things at amazing times, like Jordan being able to, put it in for three when the buzzer's going, or Tiger, making a 10-footer when it counts, or Scotty, just stepping up when he hasn't got his A game and doing something amazing under the gun where most of us would be so nervous we wouldn't be able to pull the club back. So there's certain intangibles, I think, with some of them in their makeup and their personality and their just the people they are, really, and it galvanizes itself in unbelievably steely competitors playing the toughest game on earth, for a living. And there's also, there's an element of good fortune a little bit here and there with the guys that make it compared lower down the ranks compared to the guys that don't. There's an element of right place, right time, being hot that week and not hot that week. There's lots of variables involved, but the top guys, they've just got something about them. When I coached on tour a ton in Tiger's era and just beyond that, you'd feel Tiger coming. You'd literally feel him coming. The whole range would, and that's no joke. You'd literally feel him coming. He had a presence, and just had something about him. And he went about the whole thing very differently to everyone else. Like he didn't rock up at the range for 7 hours like everybody. You hardly saw him all week. you know, God knows what he was doing in light of what we've learned about him, but he definitely wasn't practicing golf.
Jonathan, are you at the US Open this week?
I'm not. No, I haven't got a player playing this week. I've coached the guy that won it, and I've kind of, not doing a massive amount of tour work nowadays. I've kind of been there and done it a little bit. I'm doing a little bit here and there with different players, but more of a consultant nowadays.
Gotcha.
So I'm not there actually. I do miss it. I must say, I do miss it this week. I was going to rock up, but I don't like going as a tourist. I've coached that event 15 times or something. I know that course very well, actually. It's one of the few courses they slow the greens down compared to what the members play, weirdly. And it can throw up any winner, this thing,
What do you,
because of the rough.
since you know the course so well, do you have any predictions for,
It's
who
going to be
could
someone
win?
you don't really, someone that you wouldn't think of. I think it's going to produce a wild card, which the US Open often does because of so many uncontrollables. The rough's so thick. All you have to do is hit that in there a couple of times and get a really unlucky lie, you're out the game, or you could hit it in there and get a lucky lie. So there's an element of good fortune in the US Open, not from a bad perspective, because of how it's set up. The greens don't come across on TV how quick they are and how undulating, how tricky they are. I think it'll throw up a pretty unknown winner, I think. You're seeing Ryan Fox on a lot of on a really good run at the moment. Someone like that, I would say, would be someone's going to back into it like that. I would have thought, especially if I don't know what the weather's going to be like, but it's been so rainy up here in the north of America that this spring it's much more rainy than normal. So the whole thing will be so lush. I mean, you've seen it on Instagram and stuff. All the players throwing balls in, and they can't even find it when they're 5 yards away from it. So because of that, because of the lack of controllables, it will throw up a winner that you wouldn't really predict. I'd love to see Åberg win it because I love Åberg. He's such a beautiful player and such a he's like the Roger Federer of golf, I think, in the making. All he's got to do is just start to win a few and understand how to win and put it all together. But it'd be great to see him doing well. I think he's really good for the game. He's a happy, fragrant guy, isn't he? And
He's awesome.
it does a lot of things very nicely.
Yeah, he's great. But no, we were talking to our buddy who plays on the Korn Ferry Tour, and he said the only way anybody else has a chance is if Scotty has a bad week.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't really argue with that, but
No,
what do you think about that?
you can't, but it's a predictable answer, and you never know, do you? As I say, on a normal event, yeah, but it's not a normal event. He just has to hit a couple of toe struck shots with his driver into the left cabbage. You don't know. What's your guys' prediction at the winning score?
Well, last DJ won it at 5 under. He birdied the second hole to shoot 5. I mean, anything under par has got to be close, right?
Yeah, if you should, I reckon 2 or 3 under, you must be sitting pretty good there, I would have thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's your thoughts on what it looks like as a spectacle of the US Open when it's so exacting? What do you think?
I'm going up Sunday. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah.
I've seen the rough videos, obviously.
Yeah. But
I'm not.
as an event to watch, what do you think, you guys?
I mean, I think it's fun. I mean, last year was incredible watching Scotty, or not Scotty,
Yeah.
but Bryson and Rory
Yeah, yeah.
and Pinehurst, and that obviously
Yeah, I was there, yeah. Yeah,
no
yeah.
rough there.
Yeah, that's true.
I thought that was one of the more exciting ones. Wingfoot for me wasn't quite as exciting. I mean, just because Bryson, he just didn't make it exciting for whatever reason. I don't know. I think the rough was just so thick that it's like you don't really have any options on how to play the shot. You just hack it out.
I think from a spectator's point of view, it's a connoisseur's event, I always say. It's like, you're not going to see 27 under and everyone birdie and eagle everything. You've got to understand that, making par on that hole is like birdie. So you've got to be a connoisseur of the game to really get it, I think, and enjoy it for what it is, really. I think as a general spectacle, a lot of the golfing public who are used to those 20 under events won't quite get it when it's that tough.
It's one of those events that is interesting to watch, especially when it gets like this. But I'm also glad it only happens once a year.
So are the players. So are the players.
In some
It's
regard.
mentally grueling.
just because of, in some ways, especially when rough, long rough like this, greens are as hard as they are and as fast as they are. You just never know what's going to happen, and it makes it the randomness oftentimes, or can, you know, throw up someone like, and not that this was a bad thing, but oh wow, Graham McDowell won this year. Like that came out of nowhere, in some ways. Like Dustin had the lead and then played bad. That was Pebble Beach 2000, yeah. Whenever.
Yeah. But that's the charm of it. That's why it's called an open.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? That's why I like it. That's what, you know, Cooper, hey, you know, it depends how Scotty plays. Well, it does to an extent, but it depends what luck Scotty has as well, like everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's such a fine margin compared to every other event.
It is very, very fine line, which is what, again, also, as you said, makes it interesting. It can set up some unique stuff. I wanted to jump back to something you said earlier, talk about shoes and fitting. We talked with Sasha McKenzie, who had done some work with FootJoy and the shoebox and fitting guys into shoes based on their swing. And what was interesting, it wasn't all about, you know, how much ground force you have. It was also, I think, the way you put it in. When you were working with that player and changing up shoes, what kind of takeaways did you have in terms of at that time for what shoes produced different results?
Again, varies. I've done it with two or three players, actually. And again, it varies from player to player. It's literally a case-by-case basis because it depends so much on composition of your foot is the conclusion we drew. You know, if you've got no arch like me and a thin foot, you're going to interact with the ground very differently to someone who's got a big arch and a wide foot. So foot composition would be the next kind of study along to marry that together. At the moment, the only thing that I've done and I can do is, okay, let's hit a few with these shoes on. Let's hit a few with these shoes on. Let's hit a few with these shoes on. And you can start to predict, you know, if someone's more horizontal force type player, or if someone's more of a torque force early type player, you can then go, hey, you know, what we've been finding is this Nike type of shoe, heel to toe sprinter shoe is better for you, or this more solid flat to the ground shoe is better for people who swing like you. Let's try it. So it's not an exact science at the moment. It's a bit of trial and error involved from everybody. And obviously Sasha and all those guys lead the front in a lot of the research because, you know, they're professionally trained people. I'm just an educated amateur on the side, just with some good technology and an interest. But you can put two and two together and you can start to draw conclusions and make your own little tests. So I think that's where it's at the moment. I think there's still some way to go. I think it's being cottoned on to by FootJoy and people like that, which is good. But I think there have to be a way to measure people's foot composition would be the other thing to me, to enable people to understand how they put their ground reaction forces up and down into the earth.
When it comes to applying good forces into the ground, you talked about with your juniors, your focus is really grip and then good geometry that results mostly from good movement, which, you know, ground reaction forces are part of that, but more sound a lot like the Schoen stuff that Dr. Kwan talks about and plenty others do, but in terms of, you know, getting right and getting left and using the body well.
Yeah, exactly. Use the body efficiently and use it well. Don't get me wrong. I'm not an advocate of just standing there, just swinging the club. I'm an advocate of rate and speed and measuring forces, increasing forces, which increases speed. But there's a time and a place for it. And it's not just one thing. It's not just stand there and just, you know, get it as fast as you can and forget the rest. There is times when I call it my speed training sections. Okay, this is pure speed training. This is pure force training. This is pure, let's max out on everything with all the forces and whatever we're doing. Married to, okay, now we're going to work on, you know, just calming that down and adding this to it. So working on marrying that to geometry at the same time, rather than just, you know, just standing there and doing whatever you want, which kills the smash factor and a lot of other things.
So the best way, I imagine, to measure ground reaction forces with, you know, dual force plates or something of that nature. If I was at home and I was like, you know, I don't know if my ground reaction forces are any good or not, what would be some symptoms that might stick out to me?
Well, you'd have to film your swing, first of all. You know, you've got to film your swing so you know exactly some roughly what's going on. If your ground reaction forces are poor, you know, often it results in poor balance. You know, you could be spinning out of it, so your torque force is too early, your vertical force is too early. You know, what we see, really, the ground reaction force stuff is, it can be quite misleading because people are so obsessed with it that they don't understand it's a byproduct of a lot of things. So I'll give you an example of how misleading it can be. What we see in young kids who early extend is a massive magnitude of vertical force too early. So the magnitude is like off the scale, the vertical force. So if all I'm looking at is forces and I don't really know what I'm looking at, I'll go, bloody hell, this 11-year-old, my God, look at the vertical force. Well, no, they've early extended so early because the pelvis is out of position. The abs are not strong enough to control them. So it just gives you a false reading. So, you know, to answer your question, if people just focused on just making a really solid pivot, you know, what we see just as a rough guideline, you know, if they stood in their living room and just went, right, okay, this is the engine. My body's the engine, right? So just as a rough guideline, not for everybody, but it will help. On the way back, we see a movement of mass of about an inch for most players. No more than that. We don't want to be sliding around on the way back too much, right? So put your hands across your shoulders, start building up some pressure into your trail foot. You know, one of the little checkpoints when the lead arm's parallel on the forces, we see, you know, about 70-odd% of pressure in the right foot. We see a tiny little a movement of mass of about an inch. And then, you know, say to yourself, right, as I'm going to the top, what we see with really good swings and we're able to measure is now the mass and the pressure shifts to the left, upper and lower body. You know, a good way to think about it is you almost fall to the left in transition. You know, so you wind up an inch or two and then just fall left. So you feel like you're really pushing into the ground with your into your left foot. So your mass is pushing down into the ground, and that's ground reaction force. You know, for every action, there's equal opposite reaction. So if I'm now pushing down into the ground, I'm now got to push out of it, basically, and start to spin and rotate. So, you know, we go wind up, a little glide, put the brakes on the glide by a rotation and a launch. So glide, spin, launch. So if you practice that at home and then just added your arms to it, you're getting the engine working all right. You know, if your engine's not working all right, you're going to have a lack of speed. You're going to, you know, lose your balance. You're going to, you know, there's a variety of things. You'd have to film your swing to kind of see, you know, it would be my, or get a coach to look at it, or instead of guessing, get on some force plates somewhere and have a look. But
yeah,
you know, it just like a TrackMan, just like all technology, all those machines just give you the effect. They're not telling you how to fix it. That's the skill of the coach. It's just going to show you what's going on. My mass is moving that way in most players. The biggest difference between an amateur and a pro I've seen is where the pelvis moves with a pro compared to an amateur. With an amateur, most, I would say 95% of amateur players, their mass of their pelvis moves towards the ball in transition.
Yeah.
Pro players, they wind their pelvis up, they shift it out of the way and push it back, and then go. And that gives the arms room to kind of relocate and get down into position to hit it. So if I was an amateur at home, I'd be doing a lot of work with my arms across my chest, with my butt near a wall, just go and wind up, glide and push my butt back and glide and fall left, spin. You know, just getting the engine working properly. And then you'll start to feel the ground reaction. But it's, again, a bit of a buzzword, I think. And it's often a byproduct of some good stuff above it. It's just recording what's going on above it.
Absolutely. No, that makes sense. And it's interesting that fall left, I think one that's great to watch, or at least I'm not a coach, but Rory, I think, more than a lot of players, you see that move in his very distinctly.
We see it in all swings now, Daniel. We're not guessing anymore because of 3D and all the research with gears and stuff like that and Sportbox AI and stuff. Mm-hmm. So we're not guessing anymore. We know the code. So we know the range of movement on the way that way. The range of movement is 3 to 5 inches for most players. So there's a range of movement, but they're all moving that way with the whole max, upper and lower.
And it's interesting, as part of this, I was talking with a friend, buddy of ours, who's on Corn Ferry the other day, just about some of this stuff, the fourth generation, and you look at, take for example, I just saw a video, so it's on my mind. Sportsbox AI did a video with someone talking about Michael Lasasso, the individual champion's swing, and how much his pelvis moved down,
then back up.
And how he back up generates so much force from that. And it's interesting, and maybe it's should be patently obvious that it's the case because you're using the ground for both and they're both athletic movements, but how much dunking a basketball off 2 feet mirrors creating a lot of force in golf. That move that you mentioned there, the transfer and then going left, it's not like when you go left and you're shifting left, it's not like you're necessarily actively squatting down. It's more of that fall movement and then a push against, but you're lowering your center of mass, you're lowering your pelvis and then going back up. And golf and dunking, it's interestingly enough, this, if I'm going off 2 feet, let's say I'm going off 2 feet, my like second to last step, really the final step, my right foot goes forward. And the key to that is how long is taking a super long step with that foot. That lowers your body. And then when you swing your left leg around to help push off for that 2 foot dunk, your body's already low. So it's not like a step for the dunking. It's not like a step, squat, jump. It's a step that when all of a sudden you swing everything around, you're already in a squatted position and the push.
Yeah, there has to be some similarities because it's just physics. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about physics, right? It's not like it's unique to golf. You know, there's a lot of crossovers with all sports, really. But isn't it fascinating that we're in a time and an era in golf and golf coaching where an amateur like you guys and, you know, people who really love golf know a lot about it that 10 years ago, no one knew about, right? No one knew that the pelvis sunk. No one knew that the rib cage goes forward and the forward bend increases to move the mass deeply into the ground. No one knew that. Now it's common knowledge. It's common knowledge that there's nothing I could probably tell you that you don't already know about it because it's such common knowledge. And it's an amazing time to be involved, I think, because as I said to you, we're unlocking the code to everything and, you know, can only help everyone. But you can also go down the rabbit hole and get so much information as a player, you don't know where the hell you are. And that's another conversation altogether. And you can over consume content as well, which is I just see so many people so messed up from over consuming content. I can't even tell you. It's the number one thing. I can set within a minute of meeting someone. I'll go, you've been watching a lot of YouTube, haven't you? Oh, you wouldn't believe. Oh my God, Rick Shield says this, and that guy said that. And listen, it's all got merit, but it might not be helping you, my friend. So a lot of my job is to put them back on the map, really, and say, right, it's all great what you've looked at, but that bit's hurt you. So is that, and so is that. So let's reboot you as a computer. You've got too many programs running. Let's reboot you as a golf computer based on facts and evidence, and then you can go and consume whatever you like on that topic that's pertinent to you. Mm-hmm. So that's intelligent consumption of content. Because listen, is there any sport on earth that's got more stuff about it than golf? No.
Not that has the same technical component to it. Yeah, that's interesting. That's my experience. The hardest thing, I think that's been – to me, the most useful thing about having a coach is matching up that feel versus the real. I went to an instructor the other day who I'm working with, and nice guy, works with some guys on Korn Ferry. I like him. And I told him, I was like, look, I kind of know what I want to do, but I kind of see the faults, but I have no clue how to match it up. Like I have phones that I use in my simulator in my barn. And if I really wanted to, I could set up, you know, multi-camera system, live feedback, but I just can't figure out how to get this movement. And so that's where a lot of that, especially a coach, comes in, is matching up that feel. What you mentioned earlier is, you know, players rent that, but then they got to own it, and owning it is the hard part.
Well, I always say to people, that's your part of the bargain. My skill is to be able to change it and give you the answer and give you a feel. And show you and show the data changes, show the fact and evidence intervention. Your job, because you have to have some part of this bargain, is to ingrain it and practice properly and be committed to it. Otherwise, we're both wasting our time. So there's no magic wand. I can fix your swing and make it look great, put it on Instagram. doesn't make any difference if you don't work on it. It'll be the same as it was 2 days ago, in 2 days' time, if you don't work on it.
When you talk about the pyramidized practice structure that you do, do you think that helps really reboot people and get really focused on what the information they need and getting back to where they need to be when they come to you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, I reboot people and just, you know, I get lots of players from other coaches, and I never disparage them or badmouth them anyway. Just have another set of eyes look, really. And I say it's hard to argue with facts, I always say. So if I take the emotion out and I measure someone, and I just go, okay, here's what's going on, like a doctor would. Like if you were ill and you went to the doctor wouldn't put an opinion on you. He wouldn't, you know, make you do a certain thing. He just test you, and here's the report of the test. So, you know, I kind of operate like that. And so, you know, once people start getting the facts and they're not guessing and there's no emotion involved and all that sort of stuff, you can start to create an individualized roadmap for each person, and then get them to understand how to implement that. And also how to train. You know, there's no point just having a great swing and you can't break 90. You know, golf is a multifaceted game. There's so many games within the game, obviously, that you've got to master. And also you have to practice in different styles to master it. You can't just be in technical mode in a simulator all the time. You know, there's a time and a place for it all. So we created a periodized training model which flows through technical, blends it together, uses that tool competitively, and then evaluates how it's going, and then goes back through that cycle. So it's a four-stage cycle, you know, and that could, you could do that cycle in an hour, you could do it in a week, you could do it over a month. If you had 2 hours to practice, you could do the first half an hour technically on your phone, videoing it, having a look at it. You could do the next half an hour trying to get the feel and start to engage the target better. You can do the next half an hour playing against your mates and trying to kick his ass at whatever you're practicing at. And then you could sit down and get on your phone and think, right, okay, you might have a stats program, you might have some sort of program. You can just evaluate how it's all gone and just log it. And then you've had a great session. So, you know, there's different ways to train. But the bridge from the, you know, the technical improvement to the course is how you practice. You have to practice randomized practice. You have to practice. You have to get away from block practice, basically. Block practice is just how you practice to change a movement pattern. That's not how you play golf. So the change in practice style is how you use those tools in the arena. And most people never do that. And yeah, it's a big part of how I train people. That is a massive part of how I train people. And you know, even leading to an event, if I think of the US Open, there's a periodized approach to that. You know, on a Monday, you just rock up and just get, you know, get going. You get TrackMan out, you get the video out, have a quick look on a Monday. Tuesday, you know, they're going to play nine holes. You might have a little look on your phone, but you're starting to back away from the technical stuff. You might have TrackMan running, you might not. At times I've been to tour events and said, oh, the battery's dead on my TrackMan, because I don't want them to look. I want them to go into flow mode. I want them to go into artistic mode sometimes. And then on a Wednesday, you know, it's okay, it's go time. It's like, okay, let's just get competitive. Let's start practicing with your routine. Let's start hitting the shots that we're going to hit on the course. Let's, you know, you look in the practice round, you evaluate what clubs you're hitting into what holes. So you might have 3 8-irons, you might have 2 6-irons, you might have a 4-iron, you might have a hybrid off a tee, which you're probably going to have a 3-wood off a tee to some of those long par threes. So on a Wednesday on the range, you practice those. You know, so you hit 10 3-woods off a tee and you go through your routine and you visualize that long par three. So you start gearing for the tournament. So that's an example, again, of almost a little periodized training model at an event. And, you know, it starts technically and then bleeds away from it for me. And you know, sometimes the players demand you stay technical, but it's not in their interest sometimes. So that's the coaching part, which is a whole different thing from instructing.
With it being US Open week, you had a player actually 20 years ago this year that won the US Open. Yeah. Could you talk about maybe some of his prep for that week and how it went and how he won the US Open?
Yeah, that's how old I am. It makes me it feels like yesterday. Yeah, it was good. It's you know, the prep was interesting because he rocked up the day before. He'd been hitting it great. I've been working with him in Europe he'd been hitting it great. So he rocked up early one the day before at Pine Needles, because it was at Pinehurst where he won. And he came with a broom handle putter, and he's like, he's got this look on his face, like, oh my God, I can't putt. I'm hitting it as good as I've hit it. I just literally can't putt. I had 40 putts last week. I've got to use this broom handle putter. So I went, okay, again, dispassionately, I work on a system that I learned from Scotty Cameron of ball performance filming, which was quite revolutionary in that day. It's quite common now. But Scotty used to do it in his studio. So I used to do it outside with tour players and just film the ball performance and then work back from there. And so I filmed his ball performance, and it was launching it, and it was cutting, and it was all sorts of crap. So I filmed it with his broom handle putter and his real putter, and the performance was exactly the same. So I said, okay, you're not gaining anything. Let's just fix your stroke. Because historically, he's always been a great putter. And so we just fixed his stroke again, put him back in his blueprint. And I think he's number one in putting that week, which you have to be to win something like that. And, the mindset and the coaching aspect of it all week was, no one expects you to win. You're totally under the radar. You've got nothing to lose whatsoever. It's 18 flags and 18 tees, and anything else other than that, you're bringing to the table. So let's just keep with the 18 flags, 18 tees thing. And if you don't do any good, no one's going to give a shit. So, yeah, I kept him like in that mindset the whole time. And I don't think it was until he made a massive putt on 17 to be three ahead of Tiger coming down the last, with Tiger in his prime, which is obviously amazing. And then obviously he went on to win it. And certain players win it and they kick on, and he won a great tournament that week. And then certain players win big events like that and fade away. And that's what happened to him. And there's a history of people who can't cope with what comes with winning a big event, which is a whole podcast in itself. But there are, if you look historically, there's players who have won a major and disappeared, and because you don't realize as a spectator what comes with it, the attention that comes with it, the expectations that comes with it for the player and the people watching. There's lots that comes with it. So there's a lot of psychology involved, lots of things involved when you win something like that, and some people can handle it and some can't.
It's been cool to hear everything you had to say, especially because of how directly it translates over to what we're about. Because, the Tournament Code for us is about helping people learn from our mistakes we made, learn from other people's mistakes. But really, it's about, and the reason we call it the Tournament Code is because tournaments kind of, for the most part, tell you what kind of golfer you are. Like, the range is pretty, playing with your buddies for fun is pretty, but the tournament tells you what really, the tournament really is one of the best evaluations for who you are as a golfer, and what you've emphasized in terms of the periodization of being able to take it from a, golf swing to golf course to tournament has been excellent. The last question we ask every guest is the same. And so, would you mind telling us, if you could tell a junior golfer just one thing, what would that one thing be?
Enjoy the game and have fun.
I mean, that's, we hear that a lot. That's what's so interesting about it, is from players and coaches, but especially guys who have played, most of them, and even more so players who are like done playing. They're like, man, I wish I would have enjoyed it more.
Well, it becomes a grind if you're not careful, doesn't it? Especially if you play professionally. So, what hooks a kid in initially is just the enjoyment of playing and running around after it. And you might, when you become a pro, you never quite recapture that, but you're trying to always go back to that. The amount of times I've told players I work with, they're in Misery City because they're playing shit. Okay, well, let's just get back to enjoying it like you did when you were a kid. So you're always trying to get back to that start point of enjoying the game.
I understand how hard that can be. I can remember when I quit playing in college, and then in law school, I started playing again. So that was like 5, 6 years later. I was like, oh, hey, this is actually, you can kind of play and have fun. I haven't played golf for and had fun in a long time. And now I play golf and have fun all the time. If I play bad, it's like, all right, well, I got other stuff to do. And
There you go. That's it.
play good, it's like, oh, sweet, I played good. Time to
Yeah.
go do my other stuff.
There you go. That's it. That's
Well,
it.
excellent. Where can people find you on social media? Where can they find your skill list, anything related to you?
Yeah, I do. Everything's just my name. It's Jonathan Yarwood, at Jonathan Yarwood on Instagram. I do tons, too much on Instagram, actually. post too much. I'm an over poster.
Nothing
And
wrong with that.
everyone's always told me to post less. So I'm an over poster on there. And then I do a little bit on YouTube, not much. And then on Skillist, Jonathan Yarwood again, JonathanYarwood.
Excellent. And if you're listening to us right now, you can find us on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. Make sure that while you're there, you like, subscribe, leave a rating. And then if you're trying to find us on social media, you can find us on Instagram at The Tournament Code and on Twitter at Tournament Code. As always, we appreciate you joining us and diving in deeper to what it takes to play elite tournament golf.